anytime you need to leave, it's not insulting, it's not uncomfortable, it's not awkward. Do whatever you need to do whenever you need to do it. Obviously, that includes, I think officially this is supposed to be a dinner and learning type of opportunity, so feel free to eat, feel free to do your own thing, feel free to leave, like I said, whenever you need to leave. No one should be insulted. It really is, it's very, very exciting and a little bit bittersweet to be with everybody here. The bitter part comes from, I think the sweet's obvious, but the bitter part comes from the fact that there is no way to spend the time and have the conversations that I wish we were able to have and the time we were able to spend together with everybody in this room, a lot of people from different walks of life that I feel a very strong, close, personal connection with. Like I said, I wish we had forever to have the conversations and to sit down and catch up on all the things we need to catch up on and the individual conversations, but it is meaningful for me, and I hope a little bit meaningful for you at the same time, to be able to be together on some level or another. When I have the opportunity to be in America and to go around different places speaking, so even if I am reasonably sure that there is an overlap between places, then I still try, really for my own sanity more than anything else. I hate the way I sound, I hate the way I feel when I say the same thing, especially in a 20-minute or a half-hour type of sheer or talk, saying the same thing time after time. It becomes very, very fake, it becomes very, I don't know, it just feels awful when I do that. I don't like it myself. And I guess in the back of my mind, I also have the concern that you never know when someone will be there and why do they need to hear the same thing 2 nights in a row or 2 months in a row or the same thing twice. So I try as much as possible. I try not to. Sometimes I'm successful. I know some of the great speakers and leaders, they say that they never say the same thing twice. I don't know how they manage to do that. There are only so many ideas that are out there. It's hard enough to come up with different ones under any circumstances. But certainly, like I said, in similar years and similar times, try not to repeat myself all of that often. I'm going to break that rule now, not out of laziness, not because there's nothing else to talk about, and not because I'm 100% sure that none of you have heard what I want to say right now, but I want to repeat something that is at least a repetition for me. Like I said, I suspect it's not. I don't need this whole disclaimer. I think I could have said what I was going to say and no one would know that I've said it before, because I want to share with you just what I've been thinking about with very little break or respite from thinking about it over the past couple of months. And also, I want to share that with you because it's what I've been thinking about and it comes from the heart a little bit. And also because I feel a certain level of responsibility of all of the topics that would be appropriate to speak about right now, of all of the things that are going on in your lives individually and our community's lives collectively, and what life is like in YU and what things are like in November in YU and any of the other things that we could have found that have a lot to do with everybody in this room. I think this is one of the rare occasions where I actually don't have that much flexibility and have almost a responsibility and a chrayas to speak about one particular topic, which will be very, very obvious why that is when I identify it to you in a second. But that's why we're going to do it. And even if I've spoken about it before, I just don't feel like speaking about anything else. The good news, again, at least for me, if not for you, the good news is that it's not the same exact idea that I said a month ago or 2 weeks ago. It's an idea that, as I keep on thinking about it, is developing in my mind, and I'm thinking about it more and more and in a slightly different way all the time. So if that makes us feel a little bit better, that's great. Clearly, you might have guessed already, the idea relates to how we are supposed to be dealing with all of the anxiety and all of the tragedy that is around us in Israel. I speak about the level of achrayus, and I mean the level of achrayus. All of us, whether it was NCSY Kollel, and I'm not covering everybody in the room, whether it was NCSY Kollel or whether it's Reshit Yerushalayim alumni or both or some level of neither, but we all connected directly or indirectly through events and experiences that took place in some areas of the world that are very, very special to us, in the old city of Yerushalayim, and in Ben Yehuda and Machane Yehuda, in Beit Shemesh and in Reshit. And therefore, it's impossible for us not to be thinking and not to be relating to the things that are going on in Eretz Yisrael. Those things, on a certain level, I guess it would be appropriate to say that they are getting better, maybe, hopefully. People don't really know, when people are in a little bit of denial and people can begin to separate between Yehuda and Shomron and the craziness that's going on in Hebron and the really almost unspeakable challenges that they're facing over there. But maybe in Beit Shemesh and maybe in Yerushalayim, and there is lockdown or there isn't lockdown, we can get ourselves into situations to believe that it's not so terrible, and are people overreacting or underreacting, and is it as bad as this or as bad as that? Those conversations don't excite me. They don't interest me. We can all agree on the fact that there have been far too many tragedies and far too many funerals. We can all agree with the fact that the level of anxiety and the unsettledness that pervades the land of Israel right now is something that we need to be focused on. And we can all agree that we fail miserably, whether we live in Beit Shemesh or whether we live in New York. We fail miserably, generally speaking, at answering the question of what we are supposed to do about that and how we are supposed to deal with it at all. I don't profess to have a perfect answer to that question. I'm sharing with you, like I said, something I've been thinking about for the past 2 months since this began. I'm sharing with you my own personal thoughts on that issue. These are similar to the thoughts that I shared with guys in Reshit not long ago, similar to thoughts that I shared with a group of guys, some people might be here now, who were in NYU in colleges in Lower Manhattan about a month ago on my last trip in. And I'm just trying, like I said, to refine some of these ideas and to develop some of these ideas in as meaningful a way as possible, in ways that I'm hoping are helpful for me, and maybe if we're very, very lucky, they can be a little bit helpful for you as well. So that's what it is, and that's the introduction. And like I said, hopefully we can make something a little bit meaningful about that. There is an extraordinary nitziv that I want to share with you, and it goes back, and I gave you the reasons why it's fair for it to go back. It goes back, actually, where it's found is in Parshas Lech Lecha, which is a few weeks in our rearview mirror, but it relates to an idea that is certainly relevant to all of Sefer Bereishis. See, in Sefer Bereishis, there are multiple obvious themes, things that come up and that we focus on throughout the Sefer, stories that seem to repeat themselves in a Tanakh version of Maaseh Avos Simon Labanim, things that happened to Avram, that also happened to Yitzchak, that also happened to Yaakov, stories and ideas that keep on coming up. There's obviously great interactions between man and God and man and his brother, all these different things that go on. And then there are some less obvious themes that go through the entire Parsha, the entire Sefer, that we find again and again, and they don't seem to be, they seem to be almost background noise, but they're clearly there, and they're clearly meant to tell us something. Sefer Bereishis is replete with battles. Sefer Bereishis is a Sefer in which there is very little time spent with people getting along and with people living peaceful lives without conflict and without disagreement. Whether it's Cain and Hevel from the very beginning, or whether it is the stories of the relationships that the Avos have with each other, with their families, but also with their neighbors, there is a whole lot of fighting that goes on throughout Sefer Bereishis. People have a very hard time getting along. You want to skip, again, to make it more relevant to this week's parasha, you don't need to, but if you wanted to do that, then obviously we start. I mean, Yaakov's life, we talk about the defining elements of Yaakov Avinu's life. So there's Ish Emes, and there's whatever Tferes means, and all of the other indications, all of the other aspects of what Yaakov Avinu's identity was. But truth be told, Yaakov Avinu is a fighter. He fights with everybody, there is conflict with everybody, and there is no time in his life. This is the deeper, or one of the many deeper implications of the first Rashi and the famous Medrash at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. Yaakov Avinu is fatigued from this. Yaakov Avinu, when it says Vayeshev, that Yaakov Avinu, will come back to that word in the Nitziv in a minute, but Yaakov Avinu desires tranquility. He's at a stage in his life where he just wants to get along, where he just wants things to be settled and just things to be pleasant and nobody's angry and nobody's attacking and nobody's going crazy. That's what he wants. He's tired at that stage in his life and he doesn't get it even then. Whether it is Lavan or whether it is the Sar Shel Esav, whether it is Esav himself inside the womb, whether it's Esav himself in all of the different incidents in this week's Parsha, selling the Bechorah and the stealing of the Brachos and running away from home and people want to kill him, and he's all of it has to do with conflict, all of it has to do with battle. One of the battles that is most prominent in Sefer Bereishis, and less clear why it is prominent in Sefer Bereishis, is the first of the world wars that we read about in our history. The first of the world wars was in Parshas Lech Lecha, and the battle between the four kings and the five kings. And in the battle of the four kings and the five kings, you have this entire story. It is far and away the longest story pasuk-wise, if you're just counting up and listing the number of psukim for each of the incidents in Avram Avinu's life, so everybody here is aware of the fact that some of the most important events of Avram's life have no psukim dedicated to them. They exist only in Medrash, the pre-Lech Lecha stories in Avram Avinu's life, and even the stories that we do know about, Akedah, Bris Milah, Ma'aris HaMachpeh, all of them, none of them measure up to the length and to the detailed description that we have in the story of the four kings and the five kings. That alone is significant and relevant to what I want to share with you and what I want to suggest. But the Netziv makes it even more clear. Because Avram Avinu joins that story because of the fact that in the middle of the story, Lot gets involved. And one of the armies takes Lot as captive. Avram hears about it. And Avraham, this is the operative word. We're not doing any deep Torah. It's a very simple reading and paraphrasing of the Psukim in the Torah. And we'll borrow from the Netziv in the same theme in a minute. But Avram Avinu is dragged into the conflict. Avram Avinu, who is perfectly content and has nothing to do with the fact that these people are fighting, Avram Avinu through Lot is dragged into the conflict. The Netziv says something extraordinarily simple and extraordinarily clear when it speaks about that story. They're talking about the battles, they get to Sodom, they take all of the spoils of war from Sodom and Amorah, and the Torah says in Pasuk Yudbeis, Perek Yudalid, Vayichu es Lot v'es Rechusho, they also took as captives, as part of their victorious march through Sodom, they took Lot and all of Lot's property, Ben Achi Avram. Lot, in case you forgot, was the nephew of Avram. That too is significant, but probably not for now. Vayilechu, and then they went victorious, carrying the spoils of war, including the captive Lot. They went on their business. Vihu Yoshev b'Sodom. And he, at the time, was residing in Sodom. The Netziv, and you don't need to be the Netziv to be bothered by this, the Netziv says this pasuk is unnecessary. These words are out of order. And in general, these three words, they make no sense. What do we need? Again, we knew it, unnecessary. We knew, and if we didn't know, we would have clearly figured out in context that he was actually in Sodom when he was taken captive. What is significant is that he was taken captive by these armies, and then Avram's going to get involved in the battle. It's also, though, if you want to give me that information, the where and what of Lot's whereabouts, so that I can follow the story. So you do it at the beginning of the pasuk. Tell me, at the time Lot was living in Sodom, therefore, when they came to Sodom, and they were victorious, and they ran over Sodom, and took all the spoils, they took Sodom also. It's not even unnecessary, and not even out of order, it's also flat out wrong. It just said the words don't even go together. Vayelechu, and they left, v'hu yoshev b'Sodom. It's the wrong time to say that. For the previous years, he actually was in Sodom. At the point that you just said Vayelechu, he was no longer in Sodom. At this point, not only is it unnecessary, not only is it out of order, but it's not even factually correct. You chose the one time in the parak to say v'hu yoshev b'Sodom when he wasn't living in Sodom. And the Netziv says quite clearly, the Netziv says that when you have that type of difficulty, when the Torah tells you something which is unnecessary, the Torah tells you something that is questionable about whether it's even accurate or the right way to describe Lot's whereabouts, when the Torah says something out of order, it's waving a flag. It's telling you, you need to look here and you need to look closer. And the Netziv says, "Hu yoshev b'Sodom," doesn't mean that he was sitting and living in Sodom. That was obvious, that was unnecessary to be said, and it wasn't true when it was said. V'hu yoshev b'Sodom means the v'hu yoshev of the Vayeshev that we quoted earlier of Yaakov. Yoshev b'Sodom is the ultimate in passivity, and it is the ultimate in neutrality. He was on the sidelines of this conflict. He did not believe that this battle was his. He did not believe that the war had anything to do with him fundamentally. The war was not about him. V'hu yoshev b'Sodom, oblivious, passive, and neutral. He was sitting minding his own business while the world was falling apart around him. While World War I, the real World War I, was raging around him, who yoshev b'Sodom? Who you're rooting for? Not my problem. What's happening? Don't know. What are you doing about it? Not much at all. V'hu yoshev b'Sodom. And of course, says the Netziv, the entire point of the war was far more relevant to Lot than he might have ever imagined. The Netziv has an entire approach whereby everything that is going on has to do with the promise to Avraham and a threat to Avraham that he wouldn't happen to be taking the spoils of the war, but he was the focus of a lot that was going on. He was the target of the invasion of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that just heightens the contrast between what was really going on and Lot's impression, Lot's belief of V'hu yoshev b'Sodom. If you don't care for the Netziv's entire approach, and I think it's very, very compelling, so you should, but if you're not following or don't care for the entire approach of the Netziv, it's just the very fact of the prominence of this story. The story of Bereishis is the story of wars. It's the story of battles. It's the story of the fact, and this is the key, that we define ourselves based on the efforts of our enemy. We define ourselves based on the battles that we fight and the wars that we wage. A person develops and grows and figures out who they are by the total of the challenges that they face. And I don't just mean metaphorically the personal struggles and the personal challenges. I mean in a geopolitical way. I mean as a nation. I mean as people. We figure out who we are when someone sticks a finger in our chest. We figure out who we are when we get confronted and when we get challenged. And when the nations of the world try to wage war with us, we define ourselves in a meaningful way. There is no way to grow, there is no way to develop an identity when we are wrapped up and stuck in a who yoshev b'sodom mentality. The who yoshev b'sodom can mean doing good things, it can mean doing bad things, but it's a level of passivity and neutrality which are the enemies and the opposite of growth. They prevent a person from developing a full opportunity. Nobody should want wars. War is not pleasant. Nobody should want the types of tragedies or horrors that we're dealing with as a nation and as a community in Eretz Yisrael. But we should understand that it is through those sacrifices and through those challenges that a strength and a resolve is developed and that an identity is developed strongly. And I believe, not in the direction you think I'm going to suggest, I believe that in a general way, and then in a very, very specific way, this provides all of us, and I, as a resident of Israel, struggle with the exact same thing, this provides us with a definitive and clear response of what we do while all of this is going on. Because if we understand, and if we appreciate that there is a battle that is going on, and that battle is a battle for identity. That battle is between two opposing forces who strongly disagree with one another, who have different ways of looking at things. Then we double down on the identity that they wish to destroy. It's a very, very, very simple statement. I say, and I said to myself that I wasn't going to say this because I feel like I've said this part to many of you at different points in the past, but it's particularly relevant and it'll bring back memories, perhaps, for some of you who I was together with 2 summers ago. So 2 summers ago with NCSY Kollel, we spent that time under rather adverse circumstances in the middle of what was essentially a war in Israel. And that experience, which again, we could talk about for many reasons for many hours, but that experience, especially being responsible for providing a quality and safe program for all those 160 or so high school guys, so that was an interesting and a very, very unique experience to have. So forget about all of the security issues involved with that. Again, this is not the forum to discuss that, not really relevant to what we're speaking about. But I want to highlight, which I've done often, I want to highlight something that was going on there educationally there. Because it was the first time for many normal high school guys who had experiences just like virtually every single person in this room had growing up, where they were in the middle of such a kind of conflict. Young men, and I'm speaking about them because it's easier to, but I'm making clear that I'm speaking about all of us, not just when we were young, but today. Young men whose lives, and this is the point I want to make, whose lives were defined by v'hu yoshev b'sodom. Lots of things are going on, and I happen to be sitting on my couch. I happen to be sitting on my hockey team. I happen to be sitting around while all those things are going on. And they had no choice but to recognize that there is somebody in the world who is trying to destroy you. There are people who are actively, not at your brothers, not at your cousins, not at somebody 6,000 miles away. There is some, I mean, that's really what's happening. And it did not escape the attention of your average 15-year-old that somebody has just fired a missile at me. That's unusual. That's not the experience that your typical teenager has all of the time. So how does a teenager, how does a 15-year-old respond to the fact that somebody is trying to do harm to them? That somebody is actively to them right now. Iron Dome is cool, and what are the odds that it actually hit? Those things are of minor comfort when you're in a situation and there is actually somebody who is shooting a deadly missile at you. It's, again, how do they respond to that? So a number of the responses were very, very predictable. And the range and combination of responses, also predictable. Some were immature and giggly about it. Some pulled the cover over their heads and disassociated from it. Some were panicked. Some were anxious. So all sorts of reactions. Some were saddened, some were depressed, some were distracted, some were focused. All different reactions, all of which were justified, all of which, more importantly, were predictable about the way a young, developing personality would react to such an extreme circumstance. But I remember identifying in multiple conversations. I remember identifying in so many of them an unexpected reaction. And that reaction was confusion. Like, this makes no sense what's happening right now. There is no way that anybody who knows me would want to kill me. Not because I'm such a nice guy, but because I am defined by, they wouldn't have said these words, I am defined by V'hu Yoshev B'Sado. That I am the least offensive creature that God has ever created in the history of the world. I am not, what is there about me that makes you so angry? I walk down Central Avenue eating pizza, listening to rap music. That's not like a capital offense that would make somebody in Gaza want to kill me. I don't even care that much about the land of Israel. I can't tell this to my parents, I can't tell it to my school. I would not stop you from moving into East Jerusalem. Your average 15-year-old in the five towns might say. It is not a priority of mine to ensure that Jerusalem is never divided. Do you know that no high school guys even know what that sentence means? They do not know. If you suggested to them that dividing Jerusalem means putting up a wall between the Inbal and the Citadel, yes, there would be riots and they would be very upset. That would disturb them greatly. But the realities of what dividing Jerusalem might look like, there aren't many high school guys that legitimately have an opinion on that, let alone caring. I'm not, you know, that's really, if there were to be a conversation between the guys about the firing the missile and your average guy in MTA or TABC, I mean, that conversation would go like, well, what are you guys so upset about? We want to have Easter. All right, fine. You know, you can have Easter. That's okay. We hate the fact that you're laying claim to the land of Israel. I got to tell you quite honestly, I don't lay so many claims to the land of Israel, our high school boy might say. I don't have such strong affiliations with the land of Israel. If you can guarantee me a relatively enjoyable summer with a lot of ball and I can hang out with my friends, you could have the rest of it and that's okay. Save us a couple of beaches and maybe a water park. We can negotiate this. Reasonable people can get along. I promise you there's nothing about my belief system. That's the definition of a Huyoshe B'Sadom. Now, again, am I being facetious in a way? And my goal here, I assure you, is neither to make fun of high school guys, nor to say that this is in any way, shape, or form the exact dimension, the exact form of our relationship. I'm telling you that this bothers me for myself. That same confusion is something which I think at all levels of sophistication and all levels of religious commitment, it's not like a yes or no. It's not like, well, I'm not in high school anymore and my rabbi, you're insulting me. My relationship with Israel is much deeper than shawarma or a beach. I'm well aware of that. And truthfully, we all know that for many 15-year-olds, that's also the case. We're not the only ones who have a deeper connection and a more passionate and stronger feeling and bond with the land of Israel. But yet, in a war that is clearly dependent on identity, I'm not sure that we are maximizing our opportunities. I am not sure at all that we are maximizing our opportunity here to define ourselves in a certain way. And to say, this which I define myself, which is antithetical to what our enemies believe or what enemies want, this is how we will be victorious. So of course, on the general level, 2 minutes on the general, and I want to spend any remaining time we have on the specific. Of course, on the general level, that's why it always has been true and remains to be true that while it is admirable and in some cases advisable to pick yourself up, get on a plane, make aliyah, join the IDF as part of a response to what is going on, there are other responses that are also admirable and also advisable. And it is not an empty gesture to strengthen, generally speaking, Jewish identity. That's why you don't have to have a Nefesh HaChayim perspective on mystical implications of Talmud Torah and protection of the Jewish people to appreciate the value in an extra Seder or more intense Tefillah when it comes to this. That's a great, great response. I become a better person, I do more chesed, I daven with more kavana, I learn extra mishnayos because of what's going on. That's not, again, there are levels at which that begins to make sense. The level at which that makes it, number one, is that because those things present a different variation of schar v'onish calculus in the unknowable decisions that the Ribbono Shel Olam makes in the way he works makes the world, that we do believe that there is this metaphysical connection between Talmud Torah and Hashkacha Pratis in this world, and certainly Hashkacha Klalis. So I will learn more. That will be a zechus for people. That's level one. Level two is that if there is an identity war going on here, then the things that generally define me, define my identity, I will not be that confused 15-year-old. I will be a person with commitments and values that stand in opposition to those who wish to destroy us. But that's only the general level. I strongly believe that there is a more specific level. I strongly believe that we look at, and our enemies give us ample opportunity to do this, I strongly believe, and this is personally what I've been trying to work on privately, and now publicly I share it with you, I strongly believe that we can go a little bit deeper and a little bit more specific along these lines of this identity war. Who are we that they wish to destroy? Who are we standing in such contradistinction to what they believe and what they do? One of the unique aspects, just by way of example, it's not just by way of example, it's the primary example and really the most important thing I wanted to share with you. One of the unique aspects of this most recent conflict has to do with an area that I believe is generally greatly overrated, which is media reporting and media bias. People talk about this a lot. The Jewish community of North America has an unhealthy obsession with the New York Times and what they think and how accurate they are. Not only do they have a near unhealthy obsession with it, but it's an incredibly itself biased and unfair. Nobody is objective when it comes to evaluating the New York Times and how they report about different things. So many people who will say things like, you know, it's not even front page news. Israel is so disproportionately reported upon, even tragedies involving Jews or Palestinian activities, compared to things that go on in Africa or anywhere else in the world. It is a pella that Mark Twain would argue proves the existence of God and Jewish history. And where else besides the New York Times do you see Israel and Jews being the center of the world? We're not always fair when we talk about bias. I also think it's overrated because who cares? Why is the New York Times? It's just an indication of a deeply suited problem where the New York Times opinion matters to us far more than it should. And then you'll have a political guy who says, no, you have no idea the influence of that. Stop it. I do have an idea, and it does have an influence, but not near. It's not the most critical issue today. It matters much more what's happening and what it has to do with us than the middleman about how the New York Times is reporting. Having said that, it is bizarre and disturbing the levels of inaccuracies that have surrounded the most recent conflict. I don't know how many of you saw it. I suggested you do. I was speaking to a few guys earlier today. There's a big debate about how much you should be connected by watching graphic videos of the things that are going on. Is that good? At what age is it good? Should you do it? This is an issue that's raging in the school system in Israel. Reasonable people could disagree. I suggest you watch a little bit some of the times. You'll definitely learn something and be surprised by some of the things you see. It was an attack in which the attacker was killed and the Jewish victim security guard was lightly injured. There was an attack in Beitar on Sunday. I don't know how many of you saw it and also saw the way it was reported in Palestinian media. But it was to the point where, again, you can't make light of like New York Times bias. It is a complete manifestation of Olam Sheker. It is a complete manifestation of, and it's maddening what they are describing there. Some of it is typical to many of these attacks. Some of this was a new level of uniqueness. This Palestinian woman from a neighboring village approaches a security guard in Beitar. She takes out a knife and begins to stab him. She gets shot dead. Okay, not okay, but that's the scenario. That's what happened. And the Palestinian media reports about this invasion that takes place in East Bethlehem. That, by the way, is the most disturbing part, if you ask me, of the misrepresentation. NCSY Kolo used to be in Efrat. We drove through Bethlehem every single day. I am well familiar with the geography, as many of you should be, although it's been walled off, so it's been a long time since probably too many people, if ever, in this room have been in Bethlehem. Beitar, you could be pro-settlement, you could be anti-settlement. Beitar is not East Bethlehem. Beitar is a success story of Haredi Judaism, a vibrant city of multiple hundreds of thousands of Jews returning to their homeland, an area that was completely uninhabited for many, many, many centuries and developed in a city. It is not the overtaking and a military occupation of a place that does not and never existed called East Bethlehem. It's a lie and sheker from beginning to end. I'll tell you why I care so much. And of course, what is more typical and then reported all the time, this was the execution of an innocent lady. Not one mention in the Palestinian media of the circumstances of her death. Not one mention of the knife, not one mention of the attack. Israeli soldiers shooting, not CNN this time, but the Arab media, what happened today in the news, Israeli soldiers shoot and kill old elderly Palestinian woman, shot her dead on the street like that. Ulam of complete sheker and lies. I'm suggesting to you the following, though. The enemy is choosing to adorn itself and to define itself on sheker. So our response can be, and perhaps should be, letter to the editor, yes. Spend a couple of extra minutes in a chat room debating with a Palestinian professor of Middle East politics. Okay, if that floats your boat. Maybe to join an organization or contribute dollars to the organizations that are doing holy work in preventing media bias. You're getting the idea. I'm not sure how helpful any of those things are, but if it excites you, God bless you. It's better than a lot of other things that we spend time doing. But you know what we really can do? And you know what we never speak about? We can choose to define ourselves differently. I believe, and I'm not being naive and I'm not being silly, I believe an appropriate response to what is going on in Israel is to take out a Musar Sefer and to ask ourselves, are we building our own religious lives and identity on the Midah of Emes? That's something. Not an extra Seder per se, which is the general changing the calculus of the world, and also the more, still general, but slightly more specific, defining ourselves in a way that's helpful. Are we saying our enemy is choosing a battle, he is attacking us, and he is staking claim foolishly to Midas HaSheker. That will be their downfall ultimately, we believe. And we will define ourselves as people of truth. There are those who believe, if I can get slightly political for a minute, there are those who believe, and maybe they're much smarter than I am, that you fight lies with lies. That you fight, he fights dirty, I fight dirty. This is true in street fights, and this is true in world politics. I'll fight you fair, but if you start giving me low blows, or if you start cheating, well then the only way to beat you is me cheat too, or otherwise I lose. So there are those who believe we gear ourselves to fight our enemy on whatever the enemy chooses the playing field to be. I believe that is not correct. I believe when we move from the B'chu Yoshev B'Sodom, we recognize we're in a fight. We recognize that fight is a fight for identity. We're not a confused 15-year-old, and our enemies are saying, we hate that. You know what they hate? They hate the fact that we build our lives and build our communities and build our religious commitments on Midas HaEmes. That's what they hate. And if we want to beat them, we say tough on the fact that you hate them. We say to ourselves, let's commit ourselves to being not what you are. Let's commit ourselves to being the thing that you hate the most and you want to eradicate from this world. And of course, that need not, and most certainly is not, limited to the world of politics. So in a tsunu, you don't have to shout it from the rooftops, and you don't have to join a media watch organization. But in a tsunua way, we say to ourselves, that to me, in my humble opinion, do I object to a person whose kapala upon themselves is an extra set of mishnayos? Absolutely not. I think it's the appropriate response for the reasons that I said before. Do I think it's a mistake to say that I'm going to daven with extra kavana or find parts of tefillah that will be my own offering to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to deal with this situation? Absolutely not. I think that's as appropriate response to you have. I'm suggesting that what would inspire me more and that what I am accepting upon myself is to work on Midas HaEmes. Because my enemy has identified MS as being his enemy, and therefore the enemy, or however that expression goes, you'll figure it out on your own later. The enemy, and not, I guess that expression has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Enemy, my friend, okay, not that. But if that's what he is against and that's what he's battling, then that's what I stand for. Then that's what I believe, and that's what I'm going to double down on. That's the best example I know of. I'll give you another one quickly. I promise we're done in 2 minutes. This is just my thoughts. You could take them or leave them. I'll tell you what I know and I'll tell you what I think. I'll just give you one more example along those lines. Our enemy clearly has an issue with the value of life. Their lives, our lives. Lives are expendable. Lives are disposable. So we can scream about that and we can cry about that. And we could point accusing fingers about that. And there is a time and a place for all of those things. Another thing we can do is ask ourselves, are our religious lives, are our Musar lives defined by an appreciation of the value of life? Whatever way that's going to manifest itself, But there is a bracha that we say with any more kavana than Shachiyanu v'kimanu v'giyanu lazman hazeh? Do we appreciate the value of life? It doesn't have to. You don't have to be a suicide bomber to neglect the gift of life. To not be a person who appreciates that the greatest thing in the world is the lives that we live. Do we recognize the value of moments of life? Would be an example of this idea. Are we utilizing the gift of life in a proper way? So once again, will that manifest itself in extra mishnayos? It sure might, and that works too. But the way in which we get there, not I don't have to belabor the point, you understand what I'm saying. We should identify, they're different. They're trying to kill us, and they're trying to define themselves in a way that is supposed to stand at contradistinction to what we believe in. So let's believe in it. That's the way you fight a battle. Is that more important than picking up a gun and joining the IDF? I don't know. I certainly don't think it's more important. They're both really important. But is it a meaningful, thoughtful response to what's going on? I surely believe it is. Would it make our enemies really upset to know that we were doing it? Is it the ultimate way? Yeah, I believe it would. I'm not sure. I believe all of it would. I believe people learning in a base medrash late at night or having at the Hillel rally or joining in Times Square, I think that annoys them. And that means it's probably a good thing to do. I think it would annoy them more to know that everything you stand for is the antithesis of what we stand for. You're building a world of lies where we are defined by. We are known. Is this true? Is the YU community, is the Orthodox Jewish community, is this base medrash of people known for? Is that our trademark? Is that the name on our jersey, MS and Truth? Is that what we stand for? Only Yale can lay credit to that. That's on their uniform and their trademark, and not true there either. But it could be. It could be what we stand for. It could be what we are, but it isn't. And it isn't because of you and me. It isn't because that's not really our priority, and we're not mocking about certain things like this, and we're too easy to engage in the world of lies. So then we become the confused 15-year-old who doesn't even understand what the battle is about in the first place, doesn't even understand why people are upset in the first place. Hu yoshev b'sodom is not a way to live life. And it is the way that all too often we do live our lives. There is an identity that we can lay claim to. There is a way to fight this battle by strengthening this identity. And if we look at what is being fought and how it's being fought, I think we can agree that some of the things that I outline are in that category or the ways to do that, and there are a myriad more. So maybe to be a little bit more focused and a little bit more specific in the things we take on and the things we commit ourselves, and recognize the fact that sitting on the sidelines is not an option. That hu yoshev b'sodom doesn't work. That the stories and the development of the Jewish people throughout Sefer Bereishis are through battles and wars. They're not pleasant, they're not enjoyable, they may not be desirable in the slightest. But they are the things that have us emerge on the other side with a definition as a people and a definition as individuals. And like I said, I believe that that provides for us a meaningful way of responding, connecting. Things that you've heard from so many other sources are in this category as well, to be connected to what's going on, to visit this winter vacation if you have the chance to do so. The family in the five towns, who just the son who got shot, you know, friend of many of yours. What an inspiring quote on Sunday. See you in Chevron next year. I'm bringing the whole family, not just my son, next year. That's meaningful. That matters also. These are all great responses that we all are aware of and we all know about. Never has there been a more important time to spend your winter vacation in Israel. Hopefully by then things will be 10 times better, but walk through the streets of Yerushalayim proudly and safely. Take the precautions you need to take. Walk through the streets of Yerushalayim. Join the Chevron of guys who are learning in the Batei Medrash that you learned in and you grew up in, and be mechazik them as they're going through a little bit of a tricky year. It's a great, great thing to do. Read Aruch Sheva, read the newspaper, be connected, do all those things. But in Avodas Hashem, there's what we can do also with this also, and this specific focus, I believe, I know it is for me, a little bit helpful in trying to do something that's a directly meaningful response. It's great seeing everybody again. I know a lot of you have to run. Please do so. We'll see you and speak to you whenever. Great.